On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Linda Douglas in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Bush lashed out at the Democrats this week, accusing them of playing politics with funding for the troops. He made stern threats he'll veto any unacceptable bill they send his way. The British hailed the return home of 15 Marines Iran accused of crossing into its waters, while Nancy Pelosi traveled to Syria and Saudi Arabia on her own peacemaking mission. And on the home front, the presidential candidates are pulling in serious money. Up next, On Point, we'll dig into the news of the week and get behind the headlines with our top analysts. We have a great panel with us today. With me in the studio is David Gergen. He is an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton, and he's now the director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he is an editor-at-large for U.S. News and World Report. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
And also with us from Washington is Ruth Marcus. She is an editorial writer and a columnist for The Washington Post. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. Well, the press conference that the president had in the Rose Garden was full of news. He was very feisty. He threw down the gauntlet to the Democrats. And let's listen now to what the president said as he talked about how unhappy he is with the bill in Congress that would call for a troop withdrawal. He said he'd veto it.
It has now been 57 days since I requested that Congress pass emergency funds for our troops. Instead of passing clean bills that fund our troops on the front lines, the House and Senate have spent this time debating bills that undercut the troops. By substituting the judgment of politicians in Washington for the judgment of our commanders on the ground, setting an arbitrary deadline for withdrawal from Iraq, and spending billions of dollars on pork barrel projects completely unrelated to the war. I made it clear for weeks that if either the House or Senate version of this bill comes to my desk, I will veto it.
Ruth Marcus, let me start with you by asking what President Bush is really talking about here. He said that if, in fact, the Democrats provoke this standoff where there is no funding for the troops at the time at which he's requested it, they will have to prolong their tours of duty. They will have to shorten the stays of the troops who've come back to the United States. Do you think he's telling the truth or do you think he's posturing?
Both could be simultaneously true. But look, there's a lot of posturing going on both sides here. The analysis from the Congressional Research Service this week made the situation appear a lot less dire and a lot less urgent and imminent than the president makes it look like. At the same time, it's completely clear that the money is going to need to be appropriated sooner rather than later to fund the continuing operations. Everybody essentially agrees on that. And the question are what conditions and other elements should be attached. And so there's a big element of posturing. The president wants to make this look like an emergency. The Democrats respond that the emergency supplemental didn't get passed until June, I believe, last year. And there wasn't this same kind of brouhaha over undercutting troops and making everybody more unsafe in the interim.
Well, David Gergen, let me ask you about that. That is the argument that the Democrats are making, that last year the funds for the troops were not approved until June. Is this as serious a standoff? Are the troops at risk? Is this a grave confrontation as both parties are saying that it is?
It appears to have gotten more serious in the last week. Clearly, we're heading toward the passage of a bill in Congress that the president will find unacceptable, and he will veto it. And we're going to have a lot of Sturm und Drang between here and that veto. But the big issue is what happens after the veto. Do the parties, as they would traditionally do in Washington, get together and compose their differences and come up with some sort of compromise plan thereafter that would indeed keep the funds flowing to the troops while also setting some sort of conditions, not those as onerous as the president would see these as being, but would there be some way to work out a compromise? That's the way it's been traditionally done. And the dismaying aspect of this last week is the president's rhetoric about the post-veto situation hardened up a great deal. He's in a very confrontational mood. He's it's surprising to me how often he is, in this past week, he has sort of stuck a finger in the eye of the Democrats. Even in the press conference, he talked about Democrat legislators, you know, which they take as an insulting term as opposed to Democratic. And then later in the week, he sent up these recess appointments, which was another stick in the eye of the Democrats, as if, I'm not going to really work with you guys. This is going to be an all-out war. And at the same time, the Democrats, led by Harry Reid, are embracing a view that, well, in the post-veto period, we're just going to pull the plug on the spending. I don't think that's going to happen. But you don't see the air of, let's see if we can work this out on either side, which is, I think, a discouraging.
Well, the Democrats, as you point out, the majority leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, now has joined with one of the most anti-war Democratic senators, Russ Feingold, mm-hmm. to say that they would support an even tougher bill, which would cut off the funding. No non-binding language, would just cut off the funding. Ruth Marcus, let me ask you this. I mean, obviously, as David Gergen points out, the president has gotten much more confrontational, as have the Democrats. How can the Democrats now back down or get into a compromising mode themselves, given the pressure that they are feeling from the anti-war faction in their own party and from the public at large, which also seems to want the troops to pull out?
I think that's exactly right. I think that David is precisely right. The rhetoric escalated in a really dismaying way on both sides this week. And you have to think that behind the scenes and that both sides understand that while the rhetoric is going up and they each have their political reasons to up the rhetoric, they are going to, this is Washington, and the normal rules of Washington are going to have to take effect at some time, and a compromise is going to need to be reached. I think that you put your finger precisely on some of the reasons, I think, behind the escalating rhetoric on the Democrat side. They are torn between two competing imperatives. On the one hand, they have a base and, to some extent, a country that is very unhappy with this war, that wants to see some change, that they believe elected them to achieve some change. And they don't have, with a lot of that base, a lot of wiggle room to get out of the kind of cliff that they've built themselves out on. At the same time, and this is why I think in the end they will find a way to blink without appearing to blink, and that's going to be the trick. They are not going to want to be put by the Republicans in the traditional posture of Democrats looking weak on national security, Democrats looking like they are, quote unquote, undercutting the troops. And I think that the lessons of the government shutdown of almost of a decade ago, more, are disconcerting, to put it mildly, for Democrats who are thinking about how this is going to unfold.
But, of course, there are lives at stake here, as there have been throughout the beginning of and the continuing fighting of this war in Iraq. The president is making his case here that the troops may be endangered by the Democrats' moves at military bases now to the troops themselves, which adds an emotional component to the whole argument here. Some of the leading Democrats, even presidential candidate Barack Obama, the anti-war, one of the anti-war candidates, are conceding that in the end they will give in. Is that what's going to happen here?
I suspect in the end they will, but there's an emotional component on the other side. Harry Reid made his comments after he went to visit Walter Reed and talked about, you know, no more deaths, no more brain injuries. And that emotional component and impetus is behind a lot of this sentiment that's also pushing the Democrats in the other direction.
David Gergen, this is becoming a more emotional debate. We are starting to focus on the lives of the actual American soldiers who are involved, starting with much more attention being paid to Walter Reed. But again, the notion that they are now actually on stage with the president making this argument, how does that change this, if it does?
It is It would be very, very unusual. I'm not sure unprecedented, but to turn the troops into pawns in this political debate is very, very unfair to the troops and very unfair to the U.S. military. It's beneath both sides to be doing exploiting the troops in this way. My expectation is exactly that of Ruth's, and that is that in the end the troops will be funded. The Democrats are not going to pull the plug while troops are in the field on their armor, on their protection, on their rotation, on their families and the like. At the same time, Democrats, I think, are not unreasonable in saying, let's find a middle ground here. We do not want to fund an open-ended war. So I personally believe there is room for compromise.
One of the things the president was asked about at his press conference were statements made by his former campaign strategist, Matthew Dowd, who really said that he was disillusioned with the president and now thinks he's isolated and living in a bubble. Here is what President Bush said about what his former strategist had to say about him.
I respect Matthew. I've known him for a while. As you mentioned, he was an integral part of my 2004 campaign. I have not talked to Matthew about his concerns. Nevertheless, I understand his anguish over war. Understand that this is an emotional issue for Matthew, as it is a lot of other people in our country.
That was President Bush talking about his former chief campaign strategist, Matthew Dowd, talking about his having been emotional when he made these statements because Dowd's got a son who's fighting in Iraq and has turned against the war. But David Gergen, I want to ask you about another point that Dowd made in his criticism of Bush. He said that he's becoming bubbled off from people. He's becoming isolated. And then the conservative columnist Robert Novak said the same thing about President Bush. You knew President Nixon. He was accused of having gone into that same sort of disturbingly isolated state at the end of his presidency. Is there anything similar here?
There are parallels, to be sure, sadly. I think the president's press conference itself reflected a I'm not listening to you, I reject your argument kind of posture. And it's stunning at this stage in the war, with the war going as badly as it is, that he has not followed through on his promise to bring Democrats into some sort of bipartisan kind of set of conversations about the future of the Middle East, the strategy of the United States in the overall area, that instead we've got this continuing, unnecessary, Bruce may disagree with this because the Post has taken a different view on this editorially, but I thought it was unnecessary to go after Nancy Pelosi for this visit to Damascus, that was gratuitous. We just had a delegation of Republicans go there over the weekend led by Frank Wolf. There's not a peep out of the White House objecting to the Republicans going, but now Nancy Pelosi goes. And it's this over-politicized, over-partisanized aspect that seems to have left the president isolated from the discourse in the country about what's going on in the war, isolated from the sort of the concerns and the agonies that a Matthew Dowd has gone through. Matthew Dowd's a very sensitive soul. I think this has may have something to do with his son, but I think it has something to do. It's a larger a story here. There have been many Republicans who believe in President Bush who have gone through agonies as they've broken with him. They want to support him, but they're so upset about this war and the course it has taken, and they don't seem to be heard in the councils of government. And that's what makes them feel cut off from the president. That was Robert Novak's point, that so many Republicans in the Congress feel cut off from the president.
So let me ask you, Ruth Marcus, do you think that the president now is in a bunker?
I think that he is in a bunker, and he's I went back yesterday and reread the transcript of the president's press conference the day after the election, you know, olive branches and promises of civility, and I've heard the message and the voters have spoken and we're going to try to cooperate. And, you know, there's been less than any, you'd have to be totally naive to have completely believed that the promises of total bipartisanship and kumbaya on both sides. But it is really disturbing the distance that we've traveled since then, in which there just doesn't seem to have been any, or at least much, recognition from this administration that times have changed, that two things. First of all, they've got voters who are very unhappy with this war, and they may complain about undercutting the troops and danger to the troops, but at some point they're going to need to have to listen to the voters and the citizens of the country. And number two, they just haven't really accepted the new political realities on the Hill. And not only, I think the president did try to correct himself when he kept saying Democrat at the press conference, but I found these recess appointments that he made, as David mentioned earlier, really disturbing, just unnecessary, confrontational, and a bad move on as a political matter.
And I want to ask you about those recess appointments. These are appointments that the president made while Congress was not in session, of people who would might not be approved by Congress had Congress been in session. But before we do that, I want to go back to something that David said, which was, yes, the president did make a very aggressive criticism and even condemnation of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who went to Syria to meet with President Assad against the express wishes of the president and the vice president. And here is what the president had to say about Pelosi's visit.
I'm glad that our 15 service personnel have been released.
I'm sorry, that was actually Tony Blair who was talking about the release of the British soldiers. And here's what the president had to say about Speaker Pelosi's visit to Syria.
Going to Syria sends mixed signals in the region, and of course mixed signals to President Assad. And by that I mean, you know, photo opportunities and or meetings with President Assad lead the Assad government to believe they're part of the mainstream of the international community, when in fact they're a state sponsor of terror, when in fact they're helping expedite, or at least not stopping, the movement of foreign fighters from Syria into Iraq, when in fact they have done little to nothing to rein in militant Hamas and Hezbollah, and when in fact they destabilize the Lebanese democracy.
David Gergen, the president obviously very critical of Nancy Pelosi. The vice president yesterday accused her of bad behavior. But in fact, the Israeli government had to issue a statement after her visit to Syria saying that, in fact, her characterization of their offer to negotiate with Syria wasn't quite accurate. Was this visit by her a good thing? Was it an appropriate thing?
Well, Nancy Pelosi should not be trying to play Secretary of State. She is not the right person to go over there and negotiate. And I thought that was a mistake on her part to represent to one side, you know, to carry messages back and forth. On the other hand, to have a representative of this government, other representatives of this government, to visit these other countries does not seem to me to rise to the level of meriting White House attacks of the kind that were leveled against Nancy Pelosi. Other Republicans have gone. The Baker-Hamilton Commission unanimously, a bipartisan commission, unanimously argued that the United States should be reaching out and talking to Syria. We should be talking to Iran. Our own government, which has declared, this Bush administration, which declared, in effect, the government of North Korea, government non grata, they wouldn't talk to them. They sat down and bargained with them and produced good results. Here, Secretary Rice is now opening the door to talking to Iran in various ways about Iraq here in the last few days. And they just went out of their way to go after Nancy Pelosi, to sort of beat up on her because she's a Democrat and because she's a leader of the House of Representatives. I thought it was unbecoming of the administration.
And Ruth Marcus, yes, let me ask you about this, because your paper was very, the editorial pages of the Washington Post were extremely critical of Nancy Pelosi for doing this and engaging in what they called freelance foreign policy. On the other hand, you know, as David says, the Baker-Hamilton Commission, that's the one that has made recommendations for what to do about settling the situation in Iraq, has said it's important to be talking to Syria.
Sure. And actually, we completely agree with that. The question is sort of whose decision is that? The United States government, the Bush administration, ought to be engaging diplomatically way more than it has with a number of states. But that's a decision that, and I'm fascinated, really, and actually quite surprised that David and I would end up on opposite sides of this situation, because we have to have a conversation about this, David.
Ruth, you really are changing.
The world is upside down. But I have to say a couple things. Nancy Pelosi is not your ordinary member of Congress. She is the Speaker of the House. And when she goes to Syria, people listen, people pay attention, and the Syrian government uses that as an indication and a kind of status symbol of the degree to which they are taken seriously and can sort of do without the actual real administration in power. Yes, the administration undercuts itself by not having complained about the trips of Republican members of Congress, but though they have complained about some other trips to Syria in the past. And yes, there may be an element of politics at work on their side here. But I do not think of myself as a sort of more old-fashioned protector of the prerogatives of the presidency than David is. But do think that on foreign policy, an administration needs to speak with foreign leaders with one voice. And when the president decides whether he's right or wrong, and I would suggest respectfully that he's wrong, that it is not in America's diplomatic interest for the Speaker of the House, third in line to the presidency, to lend her presence to the Syrians, I kind of think she should listen.
Can I ask a quick question, Ruth?
Okay.
when we have a Democratic nominee for the presidency, eventually, at the end of this long campaign, would you object if that nominee went and spoke to the Syrian government or to people in the Middle East as on a fact-finding mission to try to determine what her or his policy might be in the future?
Well, I think you need to be very, very careful as a nominee and as a Speaker of the House or whatever, what you do. And it has to be worked out in concert with the administration. It's the kind of thing that comes up in a transition. And I think I'm sort of thinking ahead here. Betting is probably better than not that we would have a Democratic president in 2008. And I'm not sure I would like, if there were a Republican Speaker of the House or a Republican minority leader, I'm not sure I'd want to see him or her contradicting a Democratic president.
But David Gergen, aren't they kind of standing there, that is, the Democratic leaders and the president, just standing there poking each other in the eye back and forth?
Well, they are poking each other in the eye, but I really believe that it's important for members of Congress to go talk to people overseas, to understand how the world works, to begin to engage in conversations. This is traditionally been the case. Political candidates have for years gone overseas to engage in conversations in a quiet way with leaders of governments that may or may not be in good odor with the current administration in the White House. And I think that we cannot conduct a foreign policy in which only the president is allowed to talk to people and direct who can have what conversations. That is, that is shutting us down as a world power. When we have opposition leaders come over here all the time from other governments who want to confer with members of our own government, that is part of the warp and woof of how democracy should conduct their policies, in my judgment.
Okay, this is On Point, and I'm Linda Douglas. And now we have Alex calling from Providence, Rhode Island, and he's got some thoughts about Nancy Pelosi's trip to Syria. Alex, you're on the line.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. One aspect of this story that hasn't been much reported is the reason that Nancy Pelosi apparently went to Syria, which is that she was acting as a back-channel representative from the Israeli government, apparently, to relieve some tensions that had recently been developing between the two nations. Now, of course, the Israeli government has issued some sort of non-denial about this. But, Mike, it seems that Pelosi, what she was doing, it really is doing the job that the State Department should be doing, she's basically acting on behalf of the U.S. government when the U.S. government is neglecting its duties in terms of foreign relations. And it seems like part of the Bush vitriol about Pelosi has a lot to do with that. I was wondering what the panelists' thoughts were on that topic.
David?
Well, I have no evidence that she went on behalf of the Israeli government, some sort of back-channel deal. I don't think she should be acting as Secretary of State. I don't think she should be in negotiating posture. On that issue, Ruth and I are in complete agreement. That's not her role. But I do think that, given, as Ruth says, the very real possibility that the Democrats are going to win the White House, it behooves the Democratic Party to be engaged in understanding the world better than it does. We simply can't go through life having one person, the President of the United States, in effect, controlling who talks to other governments.
We also have a couple of people who want to get in, some of our callers who want to talk about this whole notion of funding for the war before we get too far away from that subject. We have Tom calling from Van Horn, Iowa. Tom, what did you want to say about the war funding dispute here?
Thank you for taking my call, Linda. Mr. Gerken, I'd like to ask or comment and ask a question of, we're going into the fifth year of this war, this invasion of Iraq, and yet Mr. Bush comes out in his news release and says the emergency funding that he's requested, where's the emergency? The emergency is they don't have an army to do it. They're still using reserve troops and National Guard troops on second and third rotations. Our army is not built up, our military, regular standing military, and it's not an emergency, is my view, and I just wonder why nobody else calls him on that.
Well, that is actually an interesting question. Thank you very much, Tom. That is an interesting question, David. Why do they call it constantly emergency funding when it's gone on year after year after year?
Well, Ruth can speak to this better than I can, I'm sure, but it is not an emergency in that sense. This has been a way for the administration for some years now, and they have not been called on it sufficiently. The caller's right about that. It's a way to keep the initial budget down. They put this side backdoor kind of funding in, and they've been able to get it done through Republican Congresses as a way to sort of hide the cost of the war, frankly. It's been very hard to get an accounting just how much this war has cost. That anybody can rely upon. Linda Belmus at the County School and others have come up with estimates that show the war has cost a heck of a lot more than the administration has said, if you take into account a lot of the ancillary costs that are engaged. So this unfortunately just become part of the and I'd love to hear what Ruth had to say about this. It's become part of the unfortunate way that the comedy between the branches has broken down.
As we have been reading all week, Hillary Clinton raised a record $26 million for her presidential campaign in the first quarter of this year. Barack Obama shocked people by raising $25 million. Let's hear what Obama had to say about the news of his massive fundraising take.
A lot of the media has been focusing on the fact that we raised a lot of money in this campaign. And they're stunned. They said, how did this guy named Obama, who hasn't been in Washington that long, how did he raise this money?
Well, I guess we'll start with you, David Gerken. How did he raise that money? And much more importantly to the people who are listening this morning, what does this mean for the campaign ahead?
Well, I think the big story of the week politically was how much Barack Obama won on the Democratic side. Mitt Romney won, secured great funding on the Republican side. But the surprise has been Barack Obama because, as he calls himself, this skinny little kid, you know, who hasn't had much background in national politics, he has galvanized through the internet and through other ways, through inspirational rhetoric, the younger community. If one goes around the country, I think there is people below the age of 35 are talking a lot about Obama, especially on college campuses, and that's why it's not just the number amount of money that he raised. It's actually the fact that he has 100,000 contributors working off a very small database, whereas Mrs. Clinton, who's got a much bigger database to work from and did very, very well, but still only had 50,000 people who contributed to her campaign. John McCain had 50,000. Mitt Romney had some 33,000. So here's Barack Obama doubling that of any other candidate in terms of the number of people signing up. This suggests that he is building a very strong grassroots effort of the kind that we saw with Deval Patrick here in Massachusetts, who won the governorship as a black candidate, and that he is to be taken very seriously. He's got a long, long way to go. He has much to live up to. People are investing an awful lot of hope in this fellow, and I'm not sure anybody could live up to all the hopes of being invested in him, but it's a remarkable start to a candidacy.
Well, Ruth Marcus of the Washington Post, doesn't this say something that is less than appealing, though, not necessarily about Barack Obama, certainly, as one of the candidates, but just the notion that there is now so much money in this campaign that is coming, yes, from grassroots donors, but also from the very wealthy. Do you think that there is going to be any kind of a serious move now to try to bring public financing, that is taxpayer-supported financing, back to the process?
Well, there's two elements to that. The short-term element is that there is a way to bring public financing back to the process in the general election campaign. Actually, thanks to Senator Obama, there is a way for the candidates to do what they need to do in terms of getting themselves ready to run the first fully privately funded presidential election since Watergate, and raise their money for the general election campaign, but to back off and essentially give that money back, relinquish that money, if their opponent were to agree to do the same. At this point, only two candidates have agreed to do that. Senator Obama on the Democratic side and Senator McCain, who's been a big proponent of fixing the presidential financing system, as is Senator Obama, on the Republican side. We have called editorially on the other candidates, particularly the candidates who purport to support a public financing system, to agree to basically an arms control agreement. Nobody wants to have their candidates spend the outrageous amount of time that these folks need to spend raising money, raising another $100 million or more for the general election. And why not just kind of agree to at least call a piece of it off? We've already lost for the primary campaign, and I think it is very, very disturbing, because what we have now is we have money first and, to some extent, message later. Mm-hmm. Usually the sort of ordinary way this is that people's message is so compelling that it enables them to raise money. Now you have to sort of come to the game with a built-in money-raising capacity in order to be able to get your message out. And it's very disturbing, which leads me to the sort of second piece mm-hmm. of this, which is the system can't be fixed for 2008, and it really ought to be fixed for 2012. And that's going to take legislation, and it's going to take the attention of the next president to get it done, because this is not a healthy process for the country to have candidates who spend more time raising money than they do talking to regular voters.
Well, and this is there are so many pieces to this, but one of the pieces is, as David Gergen was mentioning just a bit ago, that Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate, also raised an astonishing amount of money, $23 million. Paul from Milton, Massachusetts, is calling and wanting to know about where Romney's money came from. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, good day. My question is, I'm wondering, once people become familiar with Mitt Romney's change in just about every issue, whether he will become Tricky Mitt, and he's sort of limited his, perhaps, I'm asking the question, has he limited his fundraising? He's tapped into the Mormon Church for most of that $24 million, I believe. Can he go to that well again? Can he spread out, particularly when people realize that his positions on just about every issue have flip-flopped?
David,
well, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Ruth, please.
Well, we don't quite know yet where any of these candidates' money really has come from, because their formal reports aren't due until the middle of the month, and so they've only released what they'd like to release. It is clear that, for example, in contrast to Senator Obama, Governor Romney's money came in larger chunks from a smaller number of people. So to that extent, Senator Obama, for example, would have more flexibility to go back to that same well and raise additional money from the same people rather than having to find more people.
Well, and it has been reported that Mitt Romney did raise a lot of money from Mormon donors as well. But and David Gergen, you can certainly jump in on that. But I also want to ask you, David, what does this say about John McCain, who is supposed to be, was going into this race, the front runner in the polls and in the minds of I guess, the pundits, and now he didn't do so well?
The money raising confirms the trouble that John McCain's campaign has encountered unexpectedly. I think all of us felt he would be a much more formidable candidate, the man to beat, in effect, at this stage of the campaign. And for a variety of reasons of the war, the fact that he has trimmed his sails in the eyes of many independents as he sort of cater to the right, and also his age. All of those have caught up with him now. He was going to be the inevitable candidate, just as Hillary Clinton was going to be the inevitable candidate among Democrats. And now we suddenly have a race in both parties with at least three candidates in each party being very, very viable. It's not just Mitt Romney, but Giuliani has done well here recently. John McCain has slipped, and then there's Fred Thompson in the wings. And on the Democratic side, you've got the top three with John Edwards, we haven't talked about here, who's doing very well now, and is coming up in New Hampshire and in Iowa, but also the very real possibility that Al Gore could get into this before it's over. So this is very fluid. I do think that Ruth is right on one fundamental point. This money-raising campaign is taking way too much time for the candidates. And it becomes an obsession with it in the campaigns to raise money, and that is a diversion from what they really ought to be doing, and one of the reasons why we ought to change the system. But I don't think it's fair to criticize the individual candidates in the race right now for going out and trying to raise money. It's the way they have to play the game in order to be heard. And so when the New York Times editorialized against the candidates themselves for going out and raising the money under these circumstances, I thought it missed the point. How else is Barack Obama, for example, going to be taken seriously? Suddenly he's now a major serious player because he's raised all this money, and people woke up and said, wow, he's really got something going. We didn't fully understand that.
Well, and I would just want to mention one more thing about John McCain, because I actually want to switch subjects here for a minute. But McCain worsened his situation perhaps this week by saying that his walk through the market in Baghdad was safe when, in fact, he was surrounded by soldiers and Humvees and so forth. And I think this combined with the fundraising certainly has probably, as you say, David, made a kind of a problematic week for John McCain. But in that region of the country, there was another big development, which was the release of those British sailors who had been taken captive by Iran. And let us listen now to what Tony Blair, who had been conciliatory before, but what he finally said when they were released.
The international community has got to remain absolutely steadfast in enforcing its will, whether it is in respect of nuclear weapons or in respect of the support of any part of the Iranian regime for terrorism.
Ruth Marcus, who is going to come out, do you think, the winner in this? Britain was being hailed for having been so low-key and diplomatic, but now that the sailors have come back, there's been some eyebrows raised about why sailors were captured in the first place and why they apologized so quickly and what the Brits gave to the Iranians, if anything. What do you think?
I don't pretend to be an expert in this situation, but it did seem to me, just watching it from afar, it wasn't clear whether Iran meant to create the crisis that it had on its hands and sort of potentially damaging and explosive hostage-like situation. But I thought that the regime there did end up dealing actually rather nimbly with the situation. It made its point. It may have achieved some releases, and then it sort of extricated itself from the situation. And I was actually kind of watching it and hoping that President Bush and the Democratic leaders could be quite as nimble in figuring out a way to sort of stand down on the funding situation.
David?
That's a good point, Ruth. The Iran, as Ruth suggests, it was a clear winner in this. They managed to mess with the West and grab some people, and then look like they were nice guys by letting them go in political theater. But I think the larger question for us now is what lessons we draw from it in the United States in terms of our diplomacy. And people are going both ways. There are some who are arguing, I think persuasively, that this suggests that if one takes a firm stance with Iran, as Britain did, but also then negotiate with them, that it's possible that you could work out some of these disagreements, that Iran really does not want to be isolated, or elements of the government there don't want to be isolated. And there are others then, and I think it's been dismaying this week in the administration, saying, no, this doesn't change anything. There should be no lessons drawn from this. You know, full speed ahead and what appears to be a fairly confrontational stance toward Iran. It is frankly leading to a growing amount of fear around the country. We see this particularly in New England, a fear that the Bush administration is going to take on Iran militarily before this is over. Ruth, I'm not sure whether, from a Washington perspective, how that's being read.
Well, and what do you think about that, Ruth? I mean, does it suddenly make Iran look like a more serious player in terms of negotiating battles ahead?
Well, it seemed to me that the behavior of Iran in this situation was not the behavior of a crazy state. It was the behavior of a government that recognize that whether it did it intentionally or whether it did it accidentally, it had a situation. It could manipulate it to its advantage, but it could find a way to diffuse crisis. If I were looking at it, I would say this is an opportunity. As David says, it's not clear that that's what the administration is going to do. An opportunity in the sense of these are people we could potentially deal with.
Now, let us switch to yet another topic completely, if I can just get you to change subjects one more time before we end. We don't have too much time here left. But the United Nations Security Council is actually going to debate the issue this week of climate change. There's been a tremendous amount of news this week on the subject of global warming. The Supreme Court said that the Environmental Protection Agency does have the power to regulate greenhouse gases. A group of scientists have said that it is human caused by humans. Now, the UN is actually going to look at whether there are security issues. Will countries begin warring over water and food as the world heats up and dries? David Gergen, do you think that the political landscape on this has changed fundamentally just in the last couple of months?
It's in the last 6 months to a year, it's changed fundamentally. It's not just the Al Gore movie, but look at what happened with the Jeff Immelt at General Electric and other CEOs coming together, utilities, Duke Electrical Power, for example, with the environmental groups to try to work out some sort of compromise and push on reducing carbon emissions. This is this issue, which was not on the top 10 list of concern of Americans a year ago in Pew polls, is rising rapidly. It's going to be fundamental to our politics in the next few years, and thank goodness.
And Ruth Marcus, how important was that Supreme Court ruling? The Supreme Court ruling, which said that despite the protestations of the Bush administration, that the administration does actually have the power to regulate greenhouse gases.
I think it's more important in the longer term than in the shorter term. This is an administration that has not wanted to confront the seriousness of global warming. It was wrong, according to the Supreme Court, in its interpretation of the Clean Air Act, but it can sort of slow walk as it has whatever use of the regulatory power of the Clean Air Act that the Supreme Court said it is required to do under the law. I don't think that is going to it is a prod, but it is not a sort of immediate prod. And I think when I feel like every morning I wake up and I read another story on the front page of my newspaper about how global warming is a crisis and about how every round of science simply confirms and reasserts and deepens the sense that it is a real crisis. And I think it's very much time for Congress and the administration to accept the crisis and to start talking about solutions, because I don't think anybody needs more proof that we have a problem on our hands.
Right, Ruth, it strikes me that this administration, you're right, is going to slow walk through the next 2 years. We're not going to get much done. But the next president, this is going to be a fundamental challenge for the next president. It's going to require enormous courage, political dexterity to deal with this issue in the next administration.
Just a very quick final question, though, David, on this subject. Is this penetrating yet with the voters? Is this an issue of the heart yet with the voters?
I think it is. And it is. Certainly there's a groundswell among the young, and I think among a lot of people in California. It's a huge issue out in California. Give credit to Governor Schwarzenegger for the kind of leadership he has shown on it. It's a big issue in the Northeast. It's not in some parts of the middle of the country.
Okay, that's going to have to be the last word. And thank you so much to our guests, David Gergen and Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I am Linda Douglas in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.